So to continue on the discussion of the sutta called the Ganaka Mogliyana Sutta, and in it the Buddha presents a progressive series of practices leading to liberation. And he explains that when people who are serious about his practice, in his language, people who are monastics, they come to train with him. There were no retreat centers like IRC back then in ancient India, and you can drop in for a week and go back to your life and be engaged to really have time to do something like this. In a serious way, it kind of required becoming monastics. We have a different, very different culture, society now. So people would come, and probably if you were living at the time of the Buddha, I think it's a fairly high chance that some of you would have chosen to be monastics, maybe at this age in your life or something, because you're serious about the practice. And this is that was the way that it was possible to do it, and to some degree society supported it. It was understood in ancient India to support the people who did this kind of act of renunciation to engage in practice. Whereas nowadays it's strange enough just to go on a week retreat. And so the Buddha, people came to him, and he would offer them practices or a way of living that would support this movement towards liberation, towards a kind of freedom of the heart, freedom of the mind, and which is kind of at the heart of what the Buddha was about. You can only change the world so much. You can only adjust your place in sickness, old age, and death so much. You can only have success with having comfort and safety so much. There's no ultimate guarantee for anything that we can succeed in adjusting the world to our liking. Someone once said that living life is like, for many people, is like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, if you're on that last trip of the Titanic. So it's a little bit depressing to hear it that way. But the idea, the kind of idea being that, we're at some point, the life that we know and live is going to stop. It's not going to be here for us anymore. We're going to die. We're not going to be here for it. And and you can, adjust your furniture, change your clothes, but, sooner or later you have to meet this existential fact of our life. And the Buddha's solution to this, what Buddha pointed to, there can be a radical release of the heart and the mind where we no longer cause any harm to ourselves or the world around us. And that this was a noble endeavor to engage in this kind of freedom. It's a dignified, very valuable pursuit in life. And that not causing harm to ourselves is not to inflict suffering. And so that we become a safe person for ourselves. And ideally, we become a safe person for others. And so people who undertake this path of harmlessness, becoming a safe person for self and others, the Buddha offered a series of practices. And if you remember the opening evening, Diana gave a little discussion about the refuges. And she said that the refuges can have different meanings. It can be a place where we go to be safe from dangers, but it's also a place where when something's very precious and special and we want to kind of allow it to grow and nurture and, have time, refuge is a place where that can take place. And so this practice of ours, Dharma practice that we take refuge in, is meant to be a protection. And I think the only protection that really has some lasting value, or is really, you know, has some possibility of, you know, being, I don't know, guarantee is the right word, but really you can count on, is when you've learned to, when you have protection from yourself. And that you don't loathe yourself, criticize yourself, don't cling, don't hate, don't involved in greed in such a way that it actually harms you and others. There's all this way of self-harm, basically attachment of all kinds. In and of itself, the clinging, the grasping of attachment, is a kind of, at the minimum, it's a kind of stress on the whole system that sometimes is overlooked, because the promise of attachment and some of the pleasure that can come with a promise, it will override any sensitivity to the way in which it's actually a kind of, in maybe very subtle ways, a kind of self-harm. And so when we release our movement, or release or end our tendency to cling and to be attached, there is this, then we're not going to inflict that on us ourselves anymore. So we take refuge in this practice that moves there, but it's not only because we're trying to protect ourselves from safety inside and outside, but we're also trying to nourish and support something that's precious here, something that's valuable here. Your life is valuable. You're an important person, and your welfare is something well worth supporting and helping to flower and grow. It's been beautiful to watch people in the Dharma grow and blossom. And some of the people who have seen blossom the most in the most dramatic way have been people who've been practicing for some years, and then they come to the end of their lives. And something about what they've learned in the practice and coming up against the end of their life, they let go in a deep way, or they see that there's something really precious here and valuable that's here now. And something about the nowness and the immediacy of this life, a deep equanimity sets in, a peace sets in sometimes, but also a disinterest in thinking about tomorrow, because it's, you know, it's part of the imagination, but here, now, the timeless present. So there's something, there's something valuable here. And when I gave my previous talk, what I tried to present was the idea that the first two trainings the Buddha taught in the sutta, training in being ethical and the training in safeguarding yourself at the sense doors, were not meant to be world-denying, not meant to be kind of closing up and becoming a prude, because you're supposed to kind of be just, I don't know, uptight, ethically or something. It's the opposite, that there's something valuable here in our hearts, in our minds, in our lives, and that what we're trying to do is abstain from that which harms that, abstain from the things that cover that over, that don't support it to grow. And so the abstaining from unethical behavior is maybe in some ways, in terms of Western ideas, it's less about being ethical and more about letting something beautiful flower and grow. And this idea of safeguarding the sense doors, it's not about the world and you know, avoiding and the pleasures of the world, but rather not letting the pleasures of the world interfere or cover over or make a shadow over some beautiful capacity we have that can only live when we're not resisting, or we're not bottled up, or not tight, or not attached. So this idea, there's something precious here that wants to come out or can't come out. Inez talked yesterday about moderation in eating, and I had a problem with overeating when I was younger, and so I can talk from experience. How the movement of overeating would dampen and diminish my capacity to be present. I would become dull, I would become heavy, I would become not so sensitive to what was going on. And it was just kind of very unpleasant, and it kind of diminished me in some ways. And I learned that if I didn't eat so much, that actually it was enhanced. I felt more clear, more awake, and I didn't have some of this lethargy and different things and bloatedness. And I can tell you, I won't tell you, but I could tell you, amazing. I mean, it's exaggerated terms, but but in my memory, it doesn't seem exaggerated. The war stories of practicing with my over bloated stomach, and trying to deal with that. And after, why did I eat so much for lunch? And then hours before I could finally feel like I was could settle down to sit again. And I learned there was something valuable, something beautiful here that can happen if I had moderation in eating, that was very supportive for the practice. And I think that's why the Buddha was offering this moderation in eating, was to support something that was important at the practice and let that grow. Not because they're supposed to be somehow puritanical and modest or something. And then this idea of it being here, Bhikkhu Bodhi translated as being devoted to wakefulness. I kind of love the idea of devoted to wakefulness. That in English we have this, I think in Pali, this double meaning of being awake, wakefulness. It means the opposite of being asleep or sleepy. And in fact, he's saying here in this passage, just like you're supposed to have moderation in eating, be moderate in how much you sleep at night. And exactly how much you're supposed to sleep, I don't think he specifies actually. He just says that, once it gets dark, keep practicing. And then lay down very mindfully and consciously to fall asleep. And then before it gets light again, get up to practice some. And the practice he recommends is walking meditation, to walk back and forth. But while you're doing that, he has this wonderful expression. Well, it's not so wonderful, as wonderful in this translation. As you do this practice, practicing into the night and practicing in the morning, purify your mind of obstructive states, mental states, obstructive. So the Pali word for obstructive, the dictionary definitions, first definition they give is to hold back, to bottle up, to repress, to block something. And this idea of freeing oneself from how we're blocked or repressed or what's held back, free ourselves from states we hold back. So, from the states that keep us from being free. What I like about this passage, or how I interpret it, is that what do we want to really stop holding back? What we want to let it live freely through us, move through us as a beautiful force, is wakefulness. Our capacity to be awake, to be aware, to be present with an aware way, is a force, or is a capacity that we have. But it's not just simply a capacity that we can use, I'm going to be aware now and turn it on, and then we forget and it turns off after the battery wears down or something, and it's an innate part of being a human being, because we have so many different doorways or capacities for attention. Attentional capacities are the sensations of our and the nerves in our body, all the different senses we have. We have many different ways in which we take in and experience and kind of know what's happening, knowing, sensing, feeling, all these different ways. And so they all maybe come together in kind of the idea of being aware. And if you take this idea of being aware, if I told you, if I insisted, as we're sitting here, that you should stop being aware, just cut it out. It's overrated. We've done enough of it. Just stop it. If I said it that kind of way, which I won't tell you, but if I did, you'd find that you can't really turn it off when you're asked to turn it off. Like, you know, unless you kind of went to sleep or something. If you were a professional distractor, you're good at distracting, you could kind of maybe turn it on quickly, and you're kind of, you think you weren't aware, but there's still awareness operating. Awareness is built into the human functioning. And so rather than having to be mindful, do mindfulness, do awareness, this purifying, releasing of obstructive states, I like to see it, understand it as just get out of the way of awareness. Let it operate. It's here. Maybe you don't have to try so hard to be mindful, to be aware. Maybe it's more like you allow the system to operate. So again, here we have this idea that it's not so much that we have to do something, but we have to trust and allow for something that's already here, that's beautiful and valuable, to have a chance. And so here, allow this awareness to come. And so come back. So we do let go of our distracting thoughts. But as we let go of distracting thoughts, don't just let go, but then let go into being aware. Let go into the body that's aware. And, you know, what I also tried to mention when I talked about mindfulness of the body, that awareness can reside in the body. Sensing resides in the body. So if we're either because our nerves are damaged or because we're kind of cut off from parts of our body, sometimes people don't feel much. There are people who don't feel much below the neck, some people below the waist. There's a way, for all kinds of psychological reasons, people kind of disassociate, disconnect from themselves. But to kind of dwell in the body and have awareness flow, it's a beautiful thing. The analogy I like for this is it's a cold day, and then you go out and stand in the sun, and so you kind of stand there, and the sun rays come into hit your body, your clothes, and it begins to warm you up, and you really, you know, it's about time you got warm. You really like it. It feels so good. It feels, you know, you're finally not shivering or something. And I don't know, it probably doesn't help you to get warm faster, but I think it's kind of common for people to kind of maybe face the sun and kind of open up a little bit and kind of feel it in their body, kind of let it take it in. And so the body is taking in the sensations and feeling it. It's a bodily, it's a capacity to be aware that we have to use to appreciate and enjoy that warmth that's coming in. And I use that to kind of as an example because I think there's something about allowing awareness to operate that can be a little bit like settling back, letting go into it, and seeing what arises. Let things just come to awareness rather than being up in the control tower in charge, trying to make it work, trying to make things happen, and judging what's supposed to be happening, and like I used to do, like whatever I did in practice meditation, no matter what experience I had, whatever way I was practicing, it was never good enough. That was my like policy. You know, it wasn't a very good policy. But, that was my little neurosis that I thought, you know, I just had this idea that if it was happening to me, it wasn't, or the other one I had was good, was, if it's happening to me, it's not the real thing. I'd read about different states of meditation and, you know, I had things, some things that were nice happened to me and I said, well, that's not the real one. That's not what you said. You know, after all, it's happening to me. So this is, that kind of policy or operating system is a source of suffering. So it was very subtle, and it took me a long time to see how this little subtle attitude was there all the time, And there was like, you know, a little teeny voice in the control tower, I suppose. And so it had a big impact on me. But once I saw it, then I could work with it and let go of it. And a big part of practice is not being in control tower, allowing kind of the body, allowing awareness to flow, to operate, to be open to what's happening in the experience. So this devotion to wakefulness, I don't think the Pali says devotion that Bhikkhu Bodhi has here, but I looked at the Pali, but I love it anyway, the idea of devotion to awareness. And then the Buddha goes on and says, when a monastic is devoted to wakefulness, then I teach them further. Come, be possessed of mindfulness and full awareness. Be possessed. Sometimes it's a word that's translated as possessed, because that's a little bit kind of is funny in my mind. You know, come to IRC and be possessed. You know, that's, many times when people translate the particular word that's possessed, they say endowed. And you get a very different feeling if you say be possessed versus be endowed. You know, endowed, again, also, my mind also has more suggestion of something that you have, that fills you, or that has been bestowed on you in a nice way. And so be endowed with mindfulness and full awareness. And if you allow me to, you know, to offer you my preferred translations of this, the word for full awareness is sampajana, and that which more literally means some with jhana, knowing, and the pa is like more like an emphatic prefix. So with knowing clearly. So I like the translation with clear knowing, clear knowledge. So with mindfulness and clear comprehension. I like that also, not mindfulness and clear comprehension. And I'll talk about that in a moment. But here he's talking to be endowed, have present, have awakened inside of you your capacity for mindfulness and clear comprehension. So this idea of mindfulness. So here's another story, kind of, from the suttas. In India, and there are places in the mountains that are so steep, inaccessible, crevasses and crags and sharp stones, and that it's dangerous, maybe even inaccessible, for both humans and monkeys to go up there. But there's another zone where it's forested and a little bit wild, a little bit rough and dense, and where it's dangerous, not really accessible for humans, but it's accessible to the monkeys, and they can live there. And then there's a zone where it's relatively flat and open, and where it's suitable for both monkeys and humans. But if the monkeys come down to that place where it's suitable for both monkeys and humans, there are monkey hunters. And apparently in ancient India, one way to catch monkeys is you put out some kind of pitch, like tar, gorilla glue, somewhere. And maybe there's some sugar or something sweet associated with it. And the monkeys will come over and they'll put their hands in it. And then they can't get it free. So in order to get free, they take their other hand to push against it. And then both hands are stuck. And then they take one of their feet to push against this pitch tar, and that foot gets stuck. And then the second foot, do the same thing. So now both arms, both hands, and both feet are stuck in this pitch. So there's only one appendage left for, well, I shouldn't have said that, the head. And so they goes down, and they push up with their head. You push against it, and their head gets stuck. And in five ways, the Buddha said, in five ways, the monkeys get stuck. And then the hunter can just come along and pick up the monkey and do what hunters do with monkeys. But if the monkeys had stayed in what the Buddha called their ancestral homeland, that zone where humans can't go but monkeys can go, they would remain safe. So he told that story, and then he said to his practitioners, he said, you also should stay in your ancestral home where you're safe. Because if you wander away from there, you'll come to the places where there are sights, sounds, tastes, smells, and tactile objects that are alluring, captivating, compelling in some way. And if you try to grab the hold of them, you might get stuck. And, you know, the image of you stuck in those five ways is not very pretty. But to be stuck, and we do know there are people in the society and world who do get stuck in sometimes fatal ways in addiction to sense pleasures, and people will do violence to each other. It's a big deal, the challenge of how to be wise around sense pleasures. So the Buddha said, don't go there. Stay in your ancestral lands. I love the expression ancestral lands, kind of like your homeland or the place where you come from. You know, stay there. But, you know, that doesn't mean you go and lock yourself in a closet where there's in the dark, where there's no sense pleasure. It's not like rejecting sense pleasure. But where is the ancestral home where you can be safe in this world of the sense world that we live in? And so the Buddha says that your ancestral home are the four foundations of mindfulness. Mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of mind states, and mindfulness of the dharmas. So we don't have to go into what all this means right now, but the key thing is that it's in the mindfulness, a careful mindfulness of what's here for us, especially what's in our own direct experience, in the immediacy of it. And really, so we get into the three-dimensional quality of our life as we go inward. We're aware of the body, which includes the sights and sounds around us, but not so much the sights and sounds, but the experience of seeing, the experience of hearing, the experience of tasting. And it's easy to get kind of tip over into the objects of the senses, but in mindfulness we come back from the objects to really be present for the actual experience. And then you can take a step further back in the three-dimensional inner world of experience, and a little bit more depth deep inside of us is the ways in which we have a response to the world. The response of experiencing it as pleasant or unpleasant, or another pleasant or unpleasant. We can go deeper into this three-dimensional inner world and experience and see the qualities of the mind that are operating, the mind states that are operating, the ways in which there's greedy mind states, or there's hostile, aversive mind states, or deluded mind states, or there's generous mind states, or kind mind states. We can become aware of how the mind gets contracted and tight. We can be aware of how the mind states become expansive. So when we're in this world going about and we're staying close to this mindfulness practice, it's not so much paying attention to the world, but how we live in this world, how we're experiencing it in this three-dimensional inner dimension, this three-dimensional inner way. And if you do this deeper and deeper, or fuller and fuller, at some point we become aware of how we do get attached, how we hold on in different things. The hindrances, which we'll talk about tomorrow, are part of this, what we become aware of, how they operate, how they keep us caught and keep us in suffering. We start understanding something about the forces of the mind that are freeing and nurturing and supportive, to recognize how they work and how they support us and how they can grow in the practice. Things like mindfulness and investigation and energy and joy and tranquility and happiness and concentration and equanimity. And there starts to be, and in this process, we begin by being aware, be awake, and we kind of allow the wakefulness to be there. We allow awareness, present moment awareness. And then we allow the awareness, we settle back in it, and allow the awareness to begin showing us in the present moment experience as it's being lived, as the thinking mind quiets down enough, sort of feeling the kind of the richness of the experience, that there's all these different dimensions of any given experience. And we start having what's called clear comprehension. We clearly see this is pleasant, this is unpleasant. This is the mind moving towards the pleasant, wanting more. This is the mind pulling back from the unpleasant, contracting and pushing away. This is the mind or the body, you know, tightening up around being taking things so too personally. It's all about me, myself, and I, and now it's all about, you know, what people think about me, and so we can feel the contraction that goes on. So there's this clear comprehension. Look at that. I'm contracting. Look at that. I'm sinking into my self-pity. Look at that. I feel buoyed. I feel like I stayed mindful through that whole thing that happened, and I didn't fall back into my old habits of judging other people, being wrong. I just managed to get through a whole meal without making any comments or judgment about anybody else's meal and how much they ate and how they ate and what they ate and something. You know, wow. And you feel, you clearly feel, oh, I feel so much better. It's lighter to go through a meal like that. It was kind of actually kind of tiring to evaluate everybody's eating style. And so this clear comprehension, you start seeing and recognizing, not because we're analyzing or trying to understand that way, but it's a nature, it's a part of the capacity of awareness. When we settle in, relax, get quiet, become in a certain way stiller, we allow these capacities to operate, and we will know, we will be aware, we'll feel. So here in this discussion about being mindful and have clear comprehension, the Buddha says something very simple, how to do it. And it's so simple that for many years when I read these kind of passages, I think I just glossed over them. I didn't think they were relevant. I don't know what I thought, but I just ignored it. But now that I've been practicing for so long, I think this is actually quite significant. So how does one practice mindfulness and clear comprehension? Act in clear comprehension when walking forward and returning. Act in clear comprehension when looking ahead and when looking away. Act in clear comprehension when flexing and extending your limbs. Act in full awareness when wearing your robes and carrying your outer robe and bowl. act in clear comprehension when eating, drinking, consuming food, and tasting. Act in full comprehension when defecating and urinating. Act in full comprehension when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and keeping silent. So these are basic, kind of like the basic behaviors that people do as they go through their lives. And these basic behaviors, you know, that are so basic that they're like elementary or, you know, but we do it all the time, these things, to have clear comprehension of what you do. So you really see, really present for it. And it's not like you're telling yourself, now I'm standing, now I'm walking. But you could. But it's so lucid, so vivid, the presence, the attention you have to walking, that some part of you knows that you know you're walking. You really know you're walking. It's clear. You're like in the walking. So like, it's, you know, it's like you know you know. You're not just aware of it, but you're so aware that someone says, how do you know you're walking? Well, I know that I know. Somebody says, it's that kind of, the knowing stands out so clearly. It's so strong, so highlighted that you're experiencing awareness as you walk, as you sit down, as you eat, as you taste. You're right there. And it isn't so much so important the fact that you're eating or tasting or walking. What's important is the lucidity or the clarity or the fullness that you're allowing yourself to experience that. And there's a way of waking up, being awake, being aware, allowing the awareness to be there, but really allowing it to be there in its fullness. The fullness of the experience of a step. The fullness of what it's like to walk down the steps, stairways here. The fullness of eating oatmeal. You know, just the fullness of that experience. You're not going to strain, but you're going to allow it to come. I don't know if this works for you. The analogy I like, or that not the analogy, the example that works for me is if I'm going to try to hear a sound that's far in the distance, I sometimes close my eyes and I let my mind become quiet. So I'm not thinking about anything in particular. And then in that stillness or silence, I listen attentively, but I can't strain either. The fullness of listening and to hear what's there. So to have this fullness, to let go into, so not just let go of your thoughts, but to let go into, can I experience this more fully? What does this feel like? What does this sense like? What's it like in the body to experience this? When I was practicing in Burma, it became a regular thing for me to be curious about if I was going to entering into a new situation, then something happened, I would say, how's my body experiencing this? And so I was, we'd have these monsoons where just from 0 to 60 in a second, we would have these torrential monsoons coming down on the tin roofs where we were meditating. And whenever it started raining, I would immediately kind of open up, like almost like opening up all the pores in my skin, I suppose. I mean, I wasn't doing that, but it's kind of like that feeling to see, could I feel what it just shifted? Could I feel how maybe the humidity or the air pressure had shifted with all the rain? I'd kind of like, oh, what's that like? What's happening? To feel into it. Or I would go into certain rooms where certain people are at, and I would try to, with the whole body, feel, what's it like to be in this room with this person? What does it feel like, the fullness of this experience? What's it like, the fullness of this meal, to experience it, to know it, and be here with it? And it was a way that is a kind of that fullness of awareness, of clear comprehension of this, kind of necessitated not thinking about when I get home, should I buy red socks or green socks? I seem to always choose the wrong color socks. I'm a rather lousy sock chooser. I hope no one else has noticed. I bet everyone's been looking at my socks here. This is rather an embarrassment. They should have on the website what color socks we should bring so we could not, you know, we can know and not be so... Well, you go down that trail of thinking for too long, what happens to the fullness of what of the experience of the moment? You lose it. But if you take the opposite direction and let the mind become a little quieter, lovingly quiet, so you can be more fully there, then the various attentional capacities we have will operate. And one of them is also this clear comprehension. You clearly recognize, oh, here's a smell, here's a sound, here's a pleasant sensation, here's an unpleasant sensation, here's a thought. Here's a thought that nothing important is happening. Wow, I just had clear comprehension. That was pretty cool. Doesn't matter that I had the thought that nothing important is happening. That is incidental to the brilliance of having clear comprehension that I just had that thought. Wow, that's pretty cool. That's what we're going in, this clear comprehension of what's happening here now. Full awareness of what's happening here now. Bhikkhu Bodhi, who's done a lot of these translations, at one point translated mindfulness as a lucid awareness. I don't know what that does to you. Maybe it's overwhelming to think you have to have lucid awareness now. But I love this idea of this kind of this heightened clarity and awareness. So in all your activities through the retreat, and what's interesting here is so far, we've gone through now 5 different steps in the progressive training the Buddha taught, and they say nothing about meditation. That's going to be for Inez tomorrow. So you didn't have to be meditating all these days. Oh, you could have been getting ready for it, prepared by working really well at abstaining from every kind of harm-making activity that your mind can dream up. Working hard at engage fully, at really being careful at your sense doors. Be really there to take in the experience of the senses so that, not so you can indulge in them, but so that you don't grasp at anything. And really get familiar with not grasping. Because grasping is what can really diminish the beauty that's inside. And then we would have spent some time working on moderation in eating. And I don't know how difficult that would have been, but we could have done that for a while here. And then we would have worked on the sleep thing, figuring out how to maybe get a little bit less sleep, kind of not be so afraid. Some of you, we've been working on helping you get more sleep because some people have trouble sleeping. But, you know, just getting the right amount so that support a certain kind of wakefulness. And then we would have spent the rest of the time just kind of living ordinary life, walking and talking and defecating and urinating and, you know, doing the things that we do and throughout the day. And try to do it with full awareness, clear comprehension of what's going on. And all all in preparation for Inez teaching us tomorrow to engage in the meditation practices. So I kind of like I'm you know saying it this way, this odd, funny way to talk about it, maybe silly, is to emphasize the tremendous value of practicing in all your activities here at the retreat. It's not just about meditation. In fact, if you think it's all about meditation, that's what's all going to happen, that's what's supposed to happen, you're missing a great opportunity. And it's kind of meant to be a whole integrated, it's supposed to be an integrated whole, the way we're here at the retreat. And that integrated whole involves having this full awareness, or the fullest we can do, it grows over time. Real awareness here for this. Allowing this capacity to be aware here, to trust enough. You don't have to trust in anything, but to trust that it's okay not to resist anything, to trust it's okay not to push anything away, to trust it's okay not to hold on to something for dear life. Trust enough so that the fullness of awareness can blossom. So you're really here in the present moment with this experience, maybe with a quieter mind, quiet mind, quieting mind, and allowing that to grow slowly, moment by moment. It's a progressive path. The capacities we have for awareness will slowly grow, but to trust it's okay to take refuge in awareness, that it's enough, that it's significant as you walk across the floor of the community hall to be there in the fullness of experience of just walking. That when you eat your food, to be there in the fullness of the eating of that food. When you take your shower, be in the fullness of taking a shower without taking a lengthy shower. this wonderful capacity to be aware and present and simple and here will become stronger, and the forces of distraction and preoccupation and fantasy, forces of resistance and blame and resentments and desires will abate. And as these begin to shift in strength, one getting stronger and the other getting weaker, you'll discover a lot of wonderful things about that will blossom or grow inside of you. This practice of Buddhism is not a practice of denial. It's actually our diminishment. It's not like you're diminishing yourself and becoming smaller or less important. It's actually one of an enhancement. But it's the kind of enhancement that comes from the safety of awareness, from the fullness of awareness. And over time, with this clear comprehension, you'll understand really, really well. The purpose is not to be in the end fully aware, be freely here, but it's a full awareness that will allow you to see clearly how you hurt, how you harm, how you cling, how you resist, how you resent, how you get attached. You'll start seeing the little movements or the big movements of what goes on in the mind, wanting and not wanting, preferring and not preferring, judging and commentary and fantasy. You'll see it so clearly that you'll discover that it's so nice to let go of it. You don't need it. There's freedom. And you'll discover how to make yourself safe from yourself. And that is a safety that's reliable. May you live safely in the ancestral homeland, your ancestral homeland of mindfulness, of awareness.